That lines Iran's foreign minister reiterates his country's support for the resistance front in the region. Beijing has urged the United States and Japan to abandon the Cold War mentality and ideological bias against China. And the real estate company of former U.S. President Donald Trump is sentenced to pay $1.6 million. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. My name is Kisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has concluded a two-day visit to Lebanon, where he held talks with the country's top officials. Both sides stressed the significance of implementing bilateral agreements, while Lebanon's foreign minister declared that the foreign pressure is prevailing the Arab country from much-needed assistance from Iran.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian held talks Friday in Beirut with top-ranking Lebanese officials. The Iranian official said in a joint presser with his Lebanese counterpart that Iran wishes to see problems and difficulties go away in Lebanon, reiterating a previous offer to help resolve Lebanon's electricity crisis.
We would like to officially stress once more that the Islamic Republic of Iran is fully ready with its advanced scientific, engineering, and technical expertise to rehabilitate the power plants in Lebanon and even build new plants if needed, on the condition that there is consensus on this matter.
Lebanese Foreign Minister Abdullah Bouhabib revealed that foreign pressure exerted against Lebanon as well as internal disputes have been obstacles in the way of acquiring assistance from Iran. Lebanon and Iran have signed numerous agreements since 1997, yet observers say Lebanon has not implemented many of the accords as a result of Western pressure, primarily from the United States.
When we have certain factions in Lebanon that are cooperating with the U.S., then they become part of these sanctions, which are being imposed by the U.S. On the other hand, Iran wants to provide assistance to all Lebanese people. The fuel or gas that reaches Lebanon would not be for one sect or one community, but for all Lebanese, especially when they are all suffering a total blackout.
In 2012, Iran presented an offer to the Lebanese authorities under which Iran would provide fuel for electricity in a period of 6 months initially, while the Lebanese government could make down payments in Lebanese lira. Abdollahian later held separate meetings with Speaker Nabih Haberi and caretaker Prime Minister Najib Mikati and discussed the latest developments in the region and ways to improve bilateral ties. Earlier, the Iranian minister also met with Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah and discussed the latest developments in Lebanon and Palestine, especially the threat posed by the Israeli regime. Iran's foreign minister stressed that the Islamic Republic will remain a good friend of Lebanon in hard times, but it seems Lebanon has been forced by foreign powers to turn down unconditional help during the most difficult juncture in its economic history. Nariam Saleh, Beirut.
Iranians have rallied in several cities to slam the French weekly Charlie Hebdo for publishing cartoons insulting their religious sanctities and national values.
We are here to express our disgust at the insults to the religious source of emulation and to tell the enemies that we are ready to sacrifice ourselves for the leader until the last moment of our lives. They will definitely face consequences for these insults and receive a slap in the face from the Iranian nation so they don't allow themselves to make such mistakes again.
Enemies have throughout history, including the era of the Prophet and his household, taken aim at religious leaders because they are aware of the important role played by such central figures. The Holy Quran mentions in many verses that the enemies targeted the Prophet Muhammad. We should stand firm on protecting the position of the leader.
This rally is held to condemn France's filthy government, which has insulted a major religious authority of the Shia and Muslim world. We condemn this act of interference by foreigners, and we hope that the vigilant nation of Iran and Islam will take an effective stance on this issue.
These insults are nothing new. As people know, some years ago the same publication insulted the Prophet of Islam. This shows that they have a problem with Islam and not a certain person for source of emulation.
Well, protesters slammed the French government for its double standards on freedom of speech. Iran has censured the cartoons as a clear example of inciting hatred and violence. Iran has expressed regret that the French government has not dissociated itself from the cartoons and even justified them on grounds of freedom of expression. In response, Iran summoned the French ambassador and closed a Tehran-based French cultural institute in the country. Japan's prime minister has called on the U.S. and Europe to act in unison with Tokyo against China as a key challenge. Fumio Kishida says his country will never allow any attempt by China to unilaterally change the existing international order by force. Kishida also says Tokyo remains concerned about China's military activities in the East China Sea and it will reinforce its deterrence. Kishida, who is visiting the U.S., earlier met with the country's President Joe Biden. During that meeting, Biden said that Washington remains committed to its alliance with Tokyo and praised Japan's Sikh recent announcement of its illegal military overhaul since World War II. Earlier, Beijing slammed the U.S. and Japan for what it called their Cold War mentality and groundless talks on China.
China urges the United States and Japan to abandon the Cold War mentality and ideological bias, stop creating imaginary enemies and replicating the mindset of the new Cold War mentality in the Asia-Pacific, and refrain from becoming countercurrents that destabilize the Asia-Pacific region.
Wang added that the U.S. and Japan talk about promoting regional peace and security, but are rather seeking excuses for their military buildup and militarization. He made these remarks after the U.S. and Japan signed a defense agreement on Monday, following talks between the foreign ministers of the both countries. In these talks, they described China as the greatest threat and challenge in the Indo-Pacific and beyond. And American forces have conducted a joint military drill amid soaring prices and soaring tensions in the Korean Peninsula. South Korea's army say the exercises were held near the inter-Korean border. Around 800 military officers, including an elite unit from South Korea, was involved. The army said that the aim was a readiness for joint forces following the so-called North Korean recent provocation. North Korea has test-fired a large number of ballistic missiles since the beginning of the 2022 agreement. The tests come against the backdrop of a series of joint drills between the U.S. and the South. Pyongyang regards the war games as a prelude to an invasion. And a real estate company of former U.S. President Donald Trump has been fined $1.6 million for tax crimes. A New York judge imposed that sentence just hours after the Trump Organization was found guilty of committing crimes. Tax fraud, that is, and business records for 15 years. This is the first ever criminal conviction of one of Trump's companies and comes after his tax returns were released earlier this month. Still an attorney at the former federal prosecutor says the fine should not be meaningful difference for the company. Seeing its earnings, the Trump Organization has denied any wrongdoing and says that it will appeal the conviction. Trump himself has called it part of what the witch hunt continues by Democrats. He also faces several other legal challenges as he heads for the runoff of presidential elections in 2024. Now we have Colin Campbell with us, joining us from Washington, D.C. Colin, of course, we're not surprised. Donald Trump's tax was an issue even when he was a president and also during his election campaign. But as you heard in the news item, Trump himself has denied any wrongdoing. What do you think, who is right, who is wrong, and what do you think will happen to this organization? Does this hinder Trump's attempts to take part in the 2024 elections?
This is really a small amount that was when the Trump entities are forced to pay $1.6 million from a billion-dollar real estate investor out of several Trump entities. We have to remember this is more than three Trump entities. This is several of his entities. And we have to remember that this is tax evasion. So if you have several entities that make millions of dollars a year, to pay $1.6 million or be forced to pay that, even though it is the maximum penalty, is pretty small. And this is 17 counts of tax evasion, of fraud. So there are a lot of counts there. Now, if you're wondering if this would affect his run for 2024, it's highly unlikely that this will heavily impact his run. This is because we have to remember that these are his entities that were convicted of wrongdoing, not the president himself. Even though one of his closest assistants, Alan Weisselberg, was sentenced earlier, just a couple days ago, and ordered to pay $2 million on top of a five-month fine. Weisselberg worked with prosecutors to implicate Trump's entities. Trump, in return, denied that Weisselberg worked with him and said that Weisselberg worked alone and that he went rogue, basically, and did all of this illegality on his own, which many people find hard to believe. If this is one of Trump's closest advisors, then, of course, the former president have known about it. Legally, it's only the entities and companies that were found at fault, not the former president himself. So if he runs, which he already announced he would do, yes, people will question, well, you had the conviction of your companies. Those companies were you were running something fraudulent through those companies. People may say that, but would it really affect him? Not amongst his followers. We've seen the former president do a lot of things that have swung from the right side of morality, and he seems to just keep going along as we even wait for any prosecution or word coming from January 6th. That hasn't happened yet, and many people find it's going to be unlikely that we're going to hear anything about it. So again, the president will continue to run for the presidency. I don't see this as being a big problem for him trying to run.
So, Colin, what do you think is going to happen? You said that he has denied any wrongdoing. Do you think that this ruling will be revoked?
No. I think the ruling will stand. I think, again, this is just a slap on the wrist, considering that these are multi-million-dollar companies, that you have the former president who says he's a millionaire himself. I think that for this to all go away and actually put the story behind them, that this will be paid off. $1.6 million, probably a very small amount to someone like a billionaire and to companies that have $1 million, millions of dollars apiece. 1.6 is a small fee. They'll pay it off, try to put this story behind them. If anything, I think the former president may be facing other issues dealing with January 6th and maybe some other issues dealing with fraud. But with this story, once they pay that fine, I don't expect that it's going to be a major story in the headlines in months to come.
That was Colin Campbell, our correspondent, joining us from Washington, D.C. Now, U.S. police brutality takes another victim. A black man called Kenan Anderson died hours after he was repeatedly tased and restrained by Los Angeles police following a traffic accident. Anderson, 31 years old, was a teacher and a father. He was also a cousin of the Black Lives Matter co-founder, that is. Anderson went into cardiac arrest several hours after this encounter on January the 3rd. Los Angeles police released body camera footage of the incident after it sparked outcry. They say that Anderson tried to run away after the car crash. The cause of his death has yet to be officially determined. The Black Lives Matter movement says Anderson was killed by police. His death brings to three the number of people killed in encounters with the Los Angeles police in less than a week. Police brutality is one of the black people's source of public outcry in the U.S. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Prevalence of a new subvariant of Omicron in the U.S. is increasing. But whether it will cause a big surge in infections or hospitalizations isn't clear. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The scientific publication Nature wrote in this regard, "New Year, New Variant." Just as scientists were getting to grips with the alphabet soup of SARS-CoV-2 variants circulating globally, one lineage seems to be rising to the top, thanks to a peculiar new mutation. The XBB.1.5 subvariant now makes up around 28% of U.S. COVID-19 cases, according to projections from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, in Atlanta, Georgia, and its prevalence is on the rise. In the northeastern United States, it seems to have rapidly outcompeted the menagerie of other immunity-dodging variants that were expected to circulate alongside one another this winter. It's almost certainly going to dominate in the world. I cannot find a single competitor now. Everything else is incomparable, says Yang Lung Cao, an immunologist at Peking University in Beijing, whose team is studying the properties of XBB.1.5 in the lab. Scientists caution that XBB.1.5's impact in the United States and beyond is still far from clear. The variant might not cause a big surge in infections or hospitalizations in many countries, thanks to high immunity buildup from exposure to earlier waves of COVID-19 and vaccinations, particularly the recent boosters for individuals most at risk of severe disease. However, even if XBB.1.5 does not cause big COVID-19 waves, it will be important to track the lineage closely, researchers say. As its name suggests, XBB.1.5 is an offshoot of a SARS-CoV-2 variant called XBB. That lineage is a recombinant of two descendants of the BA.2 lineage that began spiking in early 2022. BA.2 itself is an offshoot of Omicron. XBB's spike protein has a suite of mutations that boost the variant's ability to evade antibodies. This has helped XBB to become common over the past few months, particularly in Asia, where it caused a surge in cases in Singapore. Variant watchers noticed XBB.1.5 in late 2022 thanks to a rarely seen amino acid change called F486P in the spike protein. Experiments from Cao's lab suggest that the mutation improves the variant's ability to attach to the human ACE2 receptor, which SARS-CoV-2 uses to invade cells. Importantly, the mutation doesn't seem to erode XBB's prowess at eluding antibodies. The results were posted to the BioRxiv preprint server on January 5th and have not yet been peer-reviewed. XBB really sucks at ACE2 binding, says Cao, and F486P change present in XBB. That helps to surmount that shortcoming. The relationship between a variant's ability to attach to ACE2 and its transmissibility isn't fully clear, says Jess Bloom, an evolutionary virologist at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center in Seattle, Washington. But for XBB.1.5, F486P seems to have given it another boost, which is enabling the virus to spread, he says. The CDC estimates that XBB.1.5 is the second most common variant in the United States, comprising 28% of cases nationally and upwards of 70% in the Northeast. Moritz Gerstang, a computational biologist at the German Cancer Research Center in Heidelberg, estimates that cases of the variant are doubling roughly every week in the United States and a bit more slowly in other countries where the variant has appeared. Jennifer Surtees, a biochemist at the University of Buffalo in New York, wonders whether researchers are overestimating XBB.1.5's growth in northeastern United States. The variant has become more common in western New York sequences her team handles, but she hasn't yet noticed the meteoric rise in XBB.1.5 genomes that labs in New York City are recording. Gauging XBB.1.5's impact might not be straightforward owing to the drop-off in testing for COVID-19. Surtees adds, I think that we are truly flying blind right now. We have no idea how many cases are really out there. Tulio do Oliveira, a bioinformation technician at Bach University in South Africa, thinks researchers should look at hospital cases and other measures of disease severity to best measure XBB.1.5's impact. Factors such as cold snap in northeastern United States, holiday gatherings could partly explain the variant's apparent surge, he says. I don't think that many scientists are jumping to conclusions and predictions very early and with very little data, he said. One thing that researchers can agree on is that XBB.1.5, like its predecessor XBB, is a master of immune evasion. It carries numerous spike mutations that blunt the potency of antibodies raised by vaccination and infection, including earlier Omicron strains. Bivalent vaccines boost levels of antibodies capable of blocking XBB infection in the lab test, but not very much, scientists say. Throughout 2022, researchers including Cao watched Omicron lineages pick up a succession of antibody-evading mutations in the viral spike protein that allowed new lineages to overcome immunity gained from vaccines and previous waves. XBB.1.5 is vastly more transmissible than other circulating variants thanks to the addition of F486P mutation, so there is currently little evolutionary pressure on the lineage to change further. But as global immunity to the subvariant builds, XBB.1.5 won't stand still. Scientists say, they say we are going to see a lot of new mutations that we have never seen before.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and congratulations to all on the birth anniversary of the most noble lady ever. The Holy Prophet's Immaculate Daughter, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her. The day which is celebrated as Mother's Day and Women's Week in the Islamic Republic of Iran. We now present you some food for thought on how devoted this lady was to God and to humanity. On her wedding night, someone knocked on the door and said, "I asked the household of the Prophet to give me an old dress." At first, Fatima thought of giving her old dress, but then remembered the words of God in the Holy Quran, which say, "By no means shall you attain righteousness unless ye give freely of that which you love or prefer." She then gave the poor person her new dress, an act that pleased God, and convey this divine satisfaction through the Archangel Gabriel to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This is the show A to Z. For today's program, Brother Muhammad is going to talk to us about Islamic education. Stay tuned.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In today's discussion with regards to Islamic education, we would like to look at an important strategy when it comes to teaching and nurturing our children into the process of salah and worship of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Salah, as we know, is an important aspect of the Islamic lifestyle, and a Muslim looks forward to and longs for praying salah every single day, 5 times a day. And our children, likewise, they need to be encouraged to pray salah. But at the same time, when they observe our demonstrations of salah and when they watch their parents pray salah or other adults, they might pick up things that are obviously wajib but are also mustahab. And at times they might be mistaken. They might be mistaken in taking those things that are wajib as mustahab or those that are mustahab as wajib, and they might end up being in a state that they have a few issues with their salah when they pray it themselves. So it is very important as a strategy that we as parents take the time and observe our children's salah for any mistakes, for any issues that might be part of that salah. This is a strategy that is taught to us by the Masumin themselves as well, that they would ask their companions to stand to pray and they would watch them to pray and give them feedback based on their salah. Or otherwise, Rasulullah one day, as it's been narrated, was sitting with a group of his companions after having prayed salah, And another man came by into the masjid and he started to pray salah. But he would pray in such a way that he would not perform the ruku, and his sujood on the ground, his prostration would be such that as if he was just pecking on the ground like a bird. And Rasulullah, when he looked at him, he said, "Oh, my companions, if you look at this person, a person like him who prays salah, if he were to die, he would not have died on the deen, on the religion of Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam." And Rasulullah at that moment explained to his companions what were the issues when it came to the person's salah. One of those was that he would peck on the ground just like a bird, or instead of performing the sujood properly with full calmness and stillness. Rather, he would just quickly put his head on the ground and get back up, and he would not complete the sujood properly. And his ruku as well did not exist, and that also was an important issue and mistake in his salah. And Rasulullah said, a person who does not perform ruku and sujood is like pecking in salah, is like a hungry person that he just takes one or two, is like a hungry person who just takes one or two pieces of dates and remains hungry and does not get satiated. And that is where Rasulullah told his companions, wudu needs to be done perfectly, and likewise perform your ruku and sujood in a perfect manner likewise. This is what will make your worship perfect and acceptable, and you will also benefit as if you are being spiritually satiated likewise by performing a complete salah. So again, when we look at our own children and as we wish for them to pray salah in the most perfect manner, we need to take time out. We need to first know salah properly, completely, with all its different aspects. And we also need to then observe our children while praying salah, such that we are able to pick out any issues that their salah has, and we are therefore able to correct it, inshallah ta'ala. I hope you enjoy today's discussion. Until next time, fi amanillah, under God's protection.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
News, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
Restoration requires intensive research and training and loads of skill. But imagine the anxiety while professionals embark on restoring rare paintings. Under careful supervision, French restorers are working to give back to 500-year-old paintings their former glory. They were rescued from a fire that engulfed the Notre-Dame Cathedral in Paris in 2019. These works date back from the 17th and early 18th century. The paintings, including 22 with large format, were temporarily stored in a warehouse and now being restored at an undisclosed location. The fire caused strictly no damage to the paintings, but they have accumulated thick layers of dirt and smoke on the surface after hanging in the cathedral for centuries. Some of the works also have paint loss due to overcleaning that restorers say need to be repaired elegantly.
Africa is taking back some of its greatest treasures stolen by the British back in the 19th century. The Horniman Museum in London has agreed to return the artifacts to Nigeria. These are 72 relics, which include 12 highly treasured brass plaques known as the Benin Bronzes. The bronzes are a group of several thousand metal plaques and sculptures that decorated the royal palace of the once mighty kingdom of Benin since the 16th century. These artifacts were looted from a region in modern-day Nigeria in a British military incursion. They later ended up in museums in Europe and the U.S. African countries have been fighting to recover works pillaged by explorers and colonizers as Western institutions grapple with the cultural legacy of colonialism.
Illegal hunting and hybridization with American crocodiles have for decades threatened their populations, with some species being on the verge of extinction. But there are some people who put their lives at risk to save the natural heritage. A Cuban researcher has released a baby crocodile that was confiscated from illegal hunters back into the wild. It was a happy moment for Etienne Perez, who went waist-deep in the dark water of Zapata Swamp to free Cuban crocs, the smallest known range of any living crocodile species. Cuban scientists were racing for quite some time to save the rarest crocodile. The government has protected virtually all of the vast swamp, widely considered to be the best preserved in the Caribbean. But the scientists say more efforts are needed to save the nature.
Releasing crocodiles seized from poachers is really impressive because we return the animal to a free life in the wild. In the case of the animals in the hatchery, we are trying to increase the historical range of the Cuban crocodile and, of course, increase the number of these individuals in the wild.
Cuban scientists estimate that around 4,000 crocodiles continue to live in the wild. But because the area they prefer within the wetland is relatively small, a climate-related disaster, increasingly common now globally, could wipe out the brunt of the population. They say illegal hunting for decades is also threatening crocodile populations. A wide range of cutting-edge digital technology is grabbing the limelight at the 2022 China International Fair for Trade in Services, which is underway in Beijing. The exhibition is featuring a wide range of products, including artificial intelligence, virtual reality, metaverse, and 5G. Visitors can be seen taking virtual reality driving lessons and enjoying scenarios, including different road and weather conditions, wearing VR kits. It's the leading and largest comprehensive fair for trade and services in China. This year, an increasing number of traditional service companies are speeding up their transformations, resorting to smart technologies. The event has set up 9 thematic exhibitions, including cultural and tourism services, education and sports services, hygiene and health services, engineering, consulting, and environmental services. Foam is fun to play with, particularly for kids, but when it's mixed with art, it also becomes a grown-up matter. And that's what a German artist has done, creating a sea of rainbow-colored foam as an interactive art piece and allowing the audience to enjoy themselves and become part of the art. Colors mixed were by Stephanie Luning were turned into rainbow-hued foam cascading down the stairs. The performance was called Island of Foam, version 18. Excited children jumped in as soon as the bubbly sea reached the base of the stairs, delighted to be playing in the rainbow playground. The art piece is made up of largely of water and a food coloring. The artist says she loves working in public spaces and reaching a broad audience of all ages.
because I like to be surprised by the result myself, and I like to work with this that you never know how it's going to turn out. You have the wind, the weather conditions, the locations, the audience. You never know how the people are going to respond and how the artwork turns out. And that's really what I like a lot, and also how to reach a broad audience.
However, Stephanie says there's tons of work behind all the fun, and cleaning up the mess can be hard. Interactive art is a form of art that achieves its purpose by involving the audience. The immersive art piece is part of the Greenwich and Docklands International Festival, an annual festival of performing arts and outdoor theatre.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Tehran Saray Gallery takes part in a massive art exhibition in South Korea, bringing Iran's leading and emerging artist to the Asian market. Works from six Iranian painters are displayed at the event, where hundreds of galleries account for more than $50 million in sales annually. Frank Smith reports from Seoul.
Seoul's annual global art exhibition has been reinvigorated this year with additional events and a most certain boost in attendance. The Korea International Art Fair continues an evolution that began with its launch back in 2002. This year features 164 galleries and more international exhibitors than ever before. That growing cosmopolitan experience and this region's growth as an art market hub is what brought a premier Iranian gallery to Seoul.
When we started this gallery, we had the big goal to just introduce Middle Eastern artists and Iranian artists to all over the world. So when you want to introduce artists, you cannot forget South Korea and Far East as well.
Sarai had participated in last year's art fair with paintings purchased by local Korean collectors. Expanding on that success at the event and as Iranian artists are growing in international stature, Hassan Saradipour decided to display works from six Iranian artists at this year's event.
Our gallery focuses on the established and emerging artists. This artist, Abbas Nasashamlu, he just want to show that how the nature and how the human can affect to each other, how this experience can bring it on the canvas, on the paper.
The massive exhibition featured paintings, although there were various multimedia and sculpture installations. As South Korean living standards have risen, more people have time and money to spend on such events. Their taste in art has also become more sophisticated.
South Korea used to lack art galleries compared to other countries. There was a serious lack of love for this level of culture. However, now these events, I think, create opportunities for more people to gain such appreciation.
For the first time this year, Freeze Art Fair in Seoul exhibited works from 110 galleries, including Picasso, other 20th century masters, and contemporary talents. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Animals, no matter pets or wild, are more vulnerable to drowning or dying in resulting floods and mudslides. A veterinarian school in Pakistan is offering free treatment for animals injured in the recent devastating floods. The veterinary surgery department of Sindh Agriculture University has set up a makeshift animal hospital as flooding hit humans and animals alike in the surrounding area. Volunteers have been providing anything from surgery to medicine and even ultrasounds to the animals free of cost. People from flood affected areas can be seen bringing their farm animals such as goats, donkeys, buffaloes, and cows into the center. The worst floods in history have killed an estimated 800,000 farm animals. But there were many heartwarming videos trolling on social media showing people come to rescue animals being stuck hopelessly.
Iran is famous for its hand-knotted carpets and ancient art, which have been loved for centuries and are never going out of style despite changing tastes and increased competition from Asia. Striking geometric shapes that recall 20th century abstract art are what we expect to see in handmade Iranian rugs. But weavers and exporters have been forced to redesign a tradition dating back more than 2,000 years due to numerous problems. Carpet exporter Ahad Azimzadeh says, however, that a revolution is underway. Iranian rugs are known for dense, curving floral designs in rich colors. They were put on display in a recent exhibition that featured a rug with small squares of hypnotic diagonal blue and white lines and another depicting diamond and other patterns in gold silk. Some countries have overtaken Iran in the global market, but many say modern carpets will never replace the traditional ones, which are deep-rooted in Iranian culture. These days, computer technology is impacting every aspect of our life, providing a greater ability to place things, events, and people within context. An Iraqi museum has started using the technology and virtual reality headsets to make exhibits interactive and to bring scenes back to life. Visitors can explore heritage sites destroyed by terrorist groups. Now using thousands of photographs, a group of local engineers have given a virtual rebirth to five historic sites in Mosul and a broad Nineveh province. That includes a mosque and its leaning minaret. But this museum brings sites back to life for the people who live in Mosul. Although large parts of the old city remain oceans of debris, authorities are trying to restore historic sites, mosques and churches in Mosul. A private museum along the Tigris River, which opened in mid-June, saw more than 4,000 visitors in its first month.
IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The reports that CIA-backed units killed hundreds of Afghan civilians in brutal night raids. According to reports, zero units backed by the U.S. made virtually no effort to distinguish non-combatants and killed with total impunity. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Throughout, citing ProPublica wrote in this regard, in 2019, reporter Lindsay Billing returned to Afghanistan to research the murders of her mother and sister nearly 30 years earlier. Instead, in the country's remote reaches, she stumbled upon the CIA's backed zero units, who conducted night raids, quick, brutal operations designed to have resounding psychological impacts while ostensibly removing high-priority enemy targets. So, Billing's attempt to catalog the scale of civilian deaths left behind by just one of four zero units, known as the 02, over a four-year period. Eyewitnesses, survivors, and family members described how zero unit soldiers had stormed into their homes at night, killing loved ones at more than 30 raid sites Billing visited. No Afghan or U.S. officials returned to investigate. In one instance, a 22-year-old named Batur witnessed the raid that killed his two brothers. One was a teacher and the other a university student. He told Billing the zero unit strategy had actually made enemies of families like his. He and his brothers, he said, had supported the government and vowed never to join the Taliban. Now, he said, he is not so sure. Little in the way of explanation was ever provided to the relatives of the dead or to their neighbors and friends as to why these particular individuals were targeted and what crimes they were accused of. Families who sought answers from provincial officials about the raids were told nothing could be done because they were zero unit operations. They have their own intelligence and do their own operation, one grieving family member remembered being told after his three grandchildren were killed in an airstrike and night raid. The provincial governor gave us a parcel of rice, a can of oil, and some sugar as compensation for the killings. At medical facilities, doctors told Billing they'd never been contacted by Afghan or U.S. investigators or human rights groups about the fate of those injured in the raids. Some of the injured later died, quietly boosting the casualty count. In a statement, CIA spokesperson Tammy Thorpe said, as a rule, the U.S. takes extraordinary measures beyond those mandated by law to reduce civilian casualties in armed conflict and treats any claim of human rights abuses with the utmost seriousness. They claimed, actually. She said any allegations of human rights abuses by a foreign partner are viewed and, if valid, the CIA and other elements of U.S. government take concrete steps, including providing training on applicable law and best practices or, if necessary, terminating assistance or the relationship. Thorpe said the Zero Units had been the target of a systematic propaganda campaign designed to discredit them because of the threat they posed to the Taliban rule. The U.S. Department of Defense did not respond to questions about Zero Unit operations. With a forensic pathologist, Billing drove hundreds of miles across some of the country's most volatile areas, visiting the sites of more than 30 raids, interviewing witnesses, survivors, family members, doctors, and village elders. To understand the program, she met secretly with Zero Unit soldiers over the course of years, wrangled with Afghanistan's former spy master in his heavily fortified home, and traveled to a diner in the middle of America to meet with an army ranger who joined the units on operations. She also conducted more than 350 interviews with the current and former Afghan and American government officials, Afghan commanders, U.S. military officials, American defense and security officials, and former CIA intelligence officers, as well as U.S. lawmakers and former oversight committee members, counterterrorism and policy officers, civilian casualty assessments experts, military lawyers, intelligence analysts, representatives of human rights organizations, doctors, hospital directors, coroners, forensic examiners, eyewitnesses, and family members, some of whom are not named in the story for their safety. While America's war in Afghanistan may be over, there are lessons to be learned from what it left behind. Billing writes, the American government has a scant basis for believing it has a full picture of the Zero Unit performance. Again and again, I spoke with Afghans who had never shared their stories with anyone. Congressional officials concerned about the CIA's operations in Afghanistan said they were startled by the civilian death toll I documented. Without a true reckoning of what happened in Afghanistan, it became clear the U.S. could easily deploy the same failed tactics in some new country against some new threat.
Mm-hmm.
Midstream.
Here I am about to leave my dark cell in which I learned not to be afraid of the dark, nor to feel alienated or lonely because I am among my brothers. With these words, Palestinian liberated detainee Karim Yunus chose to send a final message to the Palestinian people slightly before the end of his 40 years long incarceration inside Israeli occupation prisons. 40 long years Karim spent behind Zionist bars during which he lost both his parents. The Palestinian arena for which he fought witnessed many changes during this period, starting from the First Intifada to the Second, up to the multiple aggressions on Gaza and the resistance responses to it. Karim Yunus, the dean of the Palestinian prisoners, practiced his life as a Palestinian fighter inside the prisons of the occupation. The testimonies of the liberated prisoners about him were filled with expressions of his influence on the morale of the prisoners, supporting their steadfastness and permanently preserving the flame of their enthusiasm and patience. Karim continued his education while inside the detention center and did not allow the prison cells to extinguish the spark of his ideas. He even personally supervised advanced university education for a number of prisoners. He was not satisfied with keeping to himself inside the prison, but rather made himself a complete battlefield that radiated with energy. From Hadarim prison, the son of the town of Ara in northern occupied Palestine left his comrades on January 5, 2023, on board a civilian car. And after he was transported in three cars throughout the journey of surprise and misleading to thwart his reception ceremony, prepared in advance by his family to celebrate his freedom, the secret security operation, as Karim describes it, ended with him being left alone near a bus station in the town of Tabsir, which is a one-hour drive from his hometown where his family awaited him. The man of steel decided at that time not to use the bus card that the Shin Bet soldiers gave him in order to return to his hometown alone. There, the 62-year-old free man met some Palestinian workers, asked them about the name of the area, borrowed one of their phones, and informed his two brothers, who were waiting for him in front of the prison gate, of his whereabouts. His first visit was to his mother's burial site. The gentle legend fell in front of his mother's grave, who passed away only 7 months ago today. "She chose to see me free from heaven," Karim gently said, before speaking extensively about her visiting him 700 times over the course of 39 and a half years since his arrest on the 5th of January, 1983. After his liberation, the occupation tried hard to suffocate the joy of the Palestinians in general and the joy of his family in particular. However, his family and the people of his town broke the restrictions of the occupation, flaunting their celebration of Karim's freedom after 40 long years. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Many will strive to calculate the duration of his sentence in days, minutes, and seconds, while trimming the hair of his bald head and his slow but calm steps. But for Karim Yunus, what matters is that